And we are, of course, talking with recognized scholar and author Joseph Farrell tonight about ancients, giants, mythology, you name it. We're doing it on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph, for the last hour, we're talking about civilizations that could be hundreds of millions of years older than most people think.
Uh-huh.
And could they have then possessed technology which would have allowed them to do some of these incredible things we've been talking about? But then they got obliterated. Some calamity, something happened to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the whole premise here that I've been following, George, is that the calamity, in my opinion, was an actual war that decimated that society. In other words, I'm not in the catastrophist school. I don't think it was natural causes as much as it was deliberate action of a society that had possession of extremely sophisticated technology and extremely destructive weaponry. But that said, one of the things that before the break that you asked was really a great question, and it's very important to the subject of genes, giants, monsters, and men. In fact, I spend the last chapter of the book trying to figure out how do you harmonize the findings of researchers like Cremo that have indicated from archaeology that there are artifacts of intelligent beings that were here long, long before any recorded history begins. In some cases, we're dealing with artifacts that are millions of years old. So this is long, long before mankind himself in his modern form is even on the scene. Geneticists think that modern Homo sapiens was around for, 150 to 200,000 years ago, somewhere in that range. So if we're looking at artifacts that are millions of years ago, we're looking at two things, exactly as you say. We're looking at a sophisticated culture. We're looking at a sophisticated technology. And we're also looking at human beings that are somehow, in my opinion, and this is the way I attempt to resolve this, we're looking at the remains or the legacies or the monuments of our genetic cousins that were here before we were. So I think, I think we're looking at a very huge story. We've got cousins out there. They may still be out there. And, one branch of the family is here, and they came here and kind of kickstarted us into existence.
And is it possible that we did not have ET visitations? I think we did, but is it possible we didn't? Merely we had ancient ancestors on this planet.
Well, I think both, George.
That's
an excellent question. And, my model of thinking about it is probably very similar to yours, especially after doing this particular book, that if we're going to talk about ancient extraterrestrial contact, and I think there's abundant evidence that something of that nature did occur, then I think what we're looking at in terms of that contact is precisely some branch of the human genus, some branch of the human family that came here and discovered an evolutionary process underway and like I said, tried to kind of kickstart it and give it a jump and basically engineered humanity into existence. We have to hold open that possibility, again, because we are dealing with legends of that sort and the details managed to dovetail. In fact, let's mention one thing that's very significant in that regard, George.
Okay.
If we look at the legends of the Mayans and the Aztecs that my friend Scott and I examine in The Grid of the Gods, one of the things that struck us as very, very strange is that in the Aztec doctrine, for example, you have the idea of five different ages or what they call five suns, all right? And one of the peculiar things that they connect that doctrine to, just as do the Mayans, is that in each age there is a different humanity, all right? Now, many people leap on that and say, well, that's just kind of a proto-theosophical doctrine. I don't think that's what they're talking about, because if you read their texts, what they're talking about are continued manipulations of the human species by somebody in each of these ages. And if that's the case, then, you're dealing either with manipulation or they have a very good handle on evolutionary theory.
Yeah.
But either way you look at it, George, you're dealing with people that have a very sophisticated view, and that view in turn implies that at some point they had a sophisticated scientific background long ago that led to those views.
So let's jump start it and come up to where we are today.
Okay.
How much more have we learned than what you think we knew a long time ago?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful question. I think based on the research I did in Genes and Giants, that we are getting, George, to the point that we used to be. And the reason I say that is twofold. If you look at the implied science in some of these ancient texts, it's of a twofold nature. You're dealing with a very sophisticated biological science. You're dealing with a very sophisticated ability to do genetic engineering that we are just now beginning to be able to do. In other words, we are now, George, engineering chimerical creatures, creations that are half human, half animal, and so on and so forth. We've engineered cats that glow in the dark and, you know, all sorts of bizarre things. So we are looking at our return to the level of science implied by those ancient texts in terms of biology. And then the second thing I think that we are looking at, and again, this is such an excellent, important question, is that if you read those ancient texts, they imply also an extremely sophisticated physics. And I think that, again, if you look at modern accomplishments in physics, if you look at modern accomplishments in engineering with nanotechnology, we're beginning to crack the codes of quantum computing and so on and so forth. All of this, I think, indicates that we are, again, returning to the state of development that we had in those mists of prehistory. So I think, yeah, I think we're on the cusp of the very same type of civilization.
Let's get some of your let's get your take, Joseph, on the FBI releasing the vault, an incredible memo about what I think was Roswell, New Mexico, maybe also other areas where they talked about three crashed craft, alien bodies. What do you think's going on here? I mean, you've looked at this through a lot of your work over the years.
Yes.
What's happening?
Well, George, you know, the only way I can rationalize it, and again, it's an excellent question, and I'm at this juncture kind of unsettled about it. I must be quite honest. And the reason why is I think you could be looking at, on the one hand, a controlled release of information. In other words, someone wants this out at this time. And I think the reason that they may want it out at this time is I'm kind of in agreement with Richard Hoagland here. I think that we've been looking at a kind of a covert war that's been taking place not only here on Earth, but up above in outer space. And I think to a certain extent, we may be looking at a possible release of information by elites that want us to know these things. I mean, my word, George, they've also released the factor and verified the fact now that memorandum of President Kennedy ordering the CIA to release all this information to NASA concerning UFOs is more or less a true memorandum. And, you know, I've talked about that memorandum in some of my books. I know that Richard has in some of his and many others have as well. And I've always believed that it was, in fact, genuine. And now they're releasing information that tells us basically that it was. So, yeah, I have to conclude that these elites, George, for some reason, they're preparing us for something, is what it boils down to. I think they're preparing us for some sort of process of increasing gradual leaks. I'm not on the disclosure bandwagon. I don't think that they're ever going to come right out in a big, beautiful, magical day of revelation. But I do think that they are leaking these things because, again, like I say, the technology, George, that we're reaching is so reminiscent of the civilization and culture that was described in these ancient texts. And I think that these elites have to be thinking that they may be in contact with some of these genetic cousins, and we'd better get ready.
Well, I think so, too. Was there anything unsettling about your research when you were putting Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men together?
Oh, my word, yes. Yes, there was. It wasn't even any one specific thing, George. One of the most unsettling things to me was this constant feeling I kept getting as I was researching all the archaeological data, not only with Cremo and Thompson and some of the things that they've uncovered, but some things that other archaeologists, I've mentioned Adrian Mayer and other archaeologists have uncovered in this country. I kept getting the distinct feeling, George, again, that we were looking at a massive cover-up or reluctance to talk about, let's put it that way, a reluctance to talk about these things on the part of standard archaeology. And again, if you aren't willing to talk about these things, that means there's something about them that has to be unsettling to the professional academic. And again, I think all of it is due to the fact that we are dealing with clear evidence, not only of a very ancient, sophisticated civilization, but that it had some sort of interplanetary extent. And the implication, therefore, is, once again, that we may have members of the human family out there. And if that's the case, then, you know, they may be coming back. And that ties into the other big unsettling thing that I've mentioned in the first hour, is if these stories, and it's a mighty big if, let's admit, but if these stories, George, are true, that we are engineered into existence by a group of people with an agenda, then this means we're property. So if they're coming back, you know, the implication is they might be coming back to claim their property.
Sure.
And the problem here, George, is now humanity, as I've indicated, has the technology to fight back. So, you know, it's a pretty nasty scenario that emerges from all of this, and that probably was the most unsettling thing that I found.
You know, since I was a boy, I would always look toward the heavens.
Yes.
At the stars at night, Joseph, and I was just mesmerized by all of this, all
yes,
of this.
Yes, you and me both.
Yeah, and at a very young age, I just started to make up my own mind, my own conclusions,
yes,
that there's more to this universe than meets the eye. I was always very spiritual, not really religious. I wasn't an organized type of religious. You know, I went to Catholic school and,
right,
you know, catechism classes, and, you know, I did the church thing. But the older I got, I realized that, you know, you don't need organized religion to believe in God. Or,
right,
or whatever you want to call this.
Right.
But I am concluding at this point in my life that there is something out there in the universe that is extremely intelligent.
Yes.
That has put us on this planet, in this universe, for a purpose.
Yes.
And it's not merely to exist every day and, you know, to go to a baseball game or do whatever we do. It's to enhance this internal soul of ours for some bigger picture. And
yes,
I don't know yet what that bigger picture is, but I am totally convinced that there's more to this than we think.
Well, I have to agree with you, and agree with you on a number of things. I, like you, have come to the conclusion that the implications of this are so huge that increasingly, as I advance in years, I have little to do with organized religion. But yet, at the same time, like you, I think all of this has vast spiritual implications. And I agree with you. This is for some purpose. And I think, really, if you look at the body of research that I've done, at the body of research that other people in this field have done, I think most of us are coming to a similar conclusion. There is a purpose to all of this, although dissecting and designing what it might be is such a huge problem, because in order to do so, you must account for all of the legends, of all of the traditions. You can't lock yourself into one system and think that you have all the keys to the puzzle. And that's a huge task, because each culture construes that spiritual purpose slightly differently. And I think they've all got a piece of the puzzle. They've all got a clue to the puzzle. It's the problem is assembling the pieces of that puzzle, and that's the difficult thing.
We started off the interview talking about giants,
yes,
and monsters.
Yes.
Let's talk about the war against the giants. Who would have conducted the war against the giants besides the Greeks?
Well, this This is another very, very interesting question. If you look at all of the lore, the Greeks have their version, the Mayans, the Aztecs, the Hopi, the Iroquois. When I investigated this subject, George, I was astounded at the parallels between all of these very, very divergent cultures. One thing clearly emerges, and that is that there appears to be some sort of worldwide program of war against these giants, all right? In other words, it's not just a Greek thing. It's the Iroquois are doing it, the Hopi are doing it, the Aztecs are doing it, the Mayans are doing it. Basically, everybody's doing it. And they all have different reasons for why they're doing it. In some cases, the giants are kidnapping people and quite literally eating them, cannibalism. And in other cases, you get the explanation, you know, from the Bible and from the Aztecs that their sexual practices were somehow aberrant or abhorrent for whatever reason. But again, if you put it into the context of the cosmic war thesis that I advanced in that book, there is a very interesting clue in the Mesopotamian texts, and I want to mention it here because it's sure. The background for Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And the clue, George, is that this is a kind of a civil war. In other words, it's a war taking place between various branches of the pantheon of the gods. And the ultimate motivation for the war, if you read the Vedic texts, if you read the Mesopotamian texts, is somebody wants to control an extraordinarily powerful technology or to prohibit others from gaining and applying that technology. So we're looking, even in that sense, George, we're looking at kind of a metaphor of today's society as various world powers are trying to prevent other countries from gaining access to nuclear technology and so on and so forth. In other words, the motivations of this war, whatever it was, wherever it occurred, the motivations for this war were very, very modern. And that's what makes me think that these ancient texts are describing something that actually happened. So these giants enter into the picture, I think, as part of a bigger picture. They are players, they are soldiers in the combat that is involved for the control of this technology. And I'll be very blunt. I think, George, that some of this technology had to have been genetic in nature. In other words, someone wanted to control the processes and issues of life itself. And that's what had to be denied, and that's what had to be fought for.
Yeah, I think so. And you've hit it on the head once again with this latest work, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men.
Well, thank you.
Where do you get this book, Joseph?
The book is available right now at Amazon. It's also, I have a web store up on my website now, so people can actually order the books right off my website. Which is www.GizaDeathStar.com. And again, they can contact the publisher, which is Farrell House, and order the book directly from them as well.
All right, Joseph Farrell, we're going to take a surprise guest for you next half hour when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. The other book you've got coming out in a few months, in May, you said? Okay.
Yeah.
Ties into this, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, definitely. The Grid of the Gods, I just heard from my publisher today, and he's saying the end of May. That's the book I wrote with my friend Scott DeHart. And that book, that's a sequel to The Cosmic War. And if you look at the books in that series, it's The Cosmic War, The Philosopher's Stone, Babylon's Banksters, and Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And then The Grid of the Gods will continue in that series of books.
People need to email you. Can they get to you through your website?
Yes, they can. There's a contact button there, George, and if they hit that contact button, that'll send right directly to my email. The only thing I ask is that people use all capitals in the subject header so that if it's something important they want to talk to me directly about, that I'll know to open it, because I get hundreds of emails a day.
You'll get many more today, that's for sure, in the Joseph's website. Is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll come back with more. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with them right here on Coast to Coast AM. Sure is, and we're talking Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men with Joseph Farrell, the surviving elites of the cosmic war and their hidden agenda. Fascinating discussion with Joseph, and we'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. You know, when you write a book, as I have, as Joseph Farrell has, you put in special acknowledgments to people that you care about, people who have helped you get to where you are, not only in your life and your career, but also with this book. And it's kind of neat to read the acknowledgments to see who the individual truly admires and cares about in this particular time sequence. And, you know, I've written acknowledgments about my kids and people I care about, and my parents and things like that. Well, in this book, Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, I'm reading the acknowledgments that Joseph Farrell put in. And here's one of the paragraphs. It says, "The same likewise must be said for my friend Richard C. Hoagland, who also, over many emails and phone calls these past 2 years, has made his own observations and contributions to this book, particularly in how space anomalies fit into the larger picture. I hope I have done some justice to his thoughts here. Thank you, Richard." So let's bring in Richard Hoagland for the half hour here. And see, Richard, has Joseph done justice to your thoughts?
Good morning. Well, I don't quite know yet, except for what I've heard tonight, because the book that he had the publisher send me has not arrived yet. So I'm gleaning these tantalizing bits and pieces from listening to you guys.
Joseph Richard Hoagland.
Hi, Joseph.
It's almost like this is your life, Joseph.
Yeah. Oh, my.
But anyways, I wanted to bring you on, Richard, because you understand this as well as anybody. And you're the one who recommended Joseph to our program many, many years ago.
That's right.
Yep, you did. And I just wanted you to just give us your input into this.
Well, you know what I find fascinating is that There's a group of us, and there aren't very many, because this is very hard work. People think, you know, out in radio land, that they think that we are cleaning up and that we are going to our Swiss bank accounts and making millions of dollars. Yeah, Joseph is laughing because he knows where I'm going with this. This is hard work. We pay more than we actually make.
Yeah.
You know, we basically live for nothing but our work. If some of us have relationships, they suffer because, you know, we are so devoted to trying to figure out what the heck is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always pleased when Joseph writes a new book, because it's like Christmas. I can't wait. And then, you know, I try to pace it out and make it last as long as I can. And then I get to the end and there's that feeling of, when's he going to write another one?
Well, see, you didn't sign mine, Joseph. I was going to put it up on eBay and make millions on it. Oh, well. Oh, well. But,
you know,
Richard, but you're right. I mean, in the anticipation for you, because I've read it, you will love it.
Amazing. Well, what I find interesting, just listening to the conversation tonight, is that Joseph and I are on the same page in so many things, and we haven't talked about these details.
Now, no, we haven't.
That has been the hallmark of our relationship from the very beginning, when Tim Ventura introduced us. What was it? What, 5 years ago? 4 years ago?
Yeah, I think about 4 or 5 years ago, Richard.
What was so eerie is how we had reached kind of the points in our research where we had gotten to the same place, but from totally different directions.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, exactly. my component of this, which so complements what he's done, again, from what I'm hearing in this book, is that we've got a solar system filled with extraordinary, ancient, gargantuan, magnificent, awesome, mind-blowing ruins of a Type II civilization, to use Kardashev's term, which Kaku has borrowed freely and liberally,
mm-hmm.
and it's like we are prostrate in front of the gods. You can imagine what the elites realized when they finally got their first pictures of what's out there. And they found that everything in their ancient sacred texts, the stuff that we've never seen, the stuff that they've spent fortunes combing the globe to find a parchment here, a tablet there. I mean, the whole thing with Iraq still, I think, was about going and plundering the 80,000 tablets in the museum in Baghdad that never saw the light of day after we basically invaded that country.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree.
So if we've got all that incredible stuff out there, how are the guys here approaching it? And God help us if the owners are coming back.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I think that it's fairly clear that, at least from the study of the activities of the elite that I try to undertake in this book, Richard, that this is one of their major concerns, and that's why I spent the time I did in the book with patent law and examining ancient texts in terms of modern patent law, because it's very, very clear once you compare the two that the law would say we're property. So, yeah, it poses some very thorny questions.
You know, what I've always found interesting, and there's been a lot of critics, not a lot, but a few persistent critics. There's a guy named Expat that's been out after me and Mike for years and years because of Dark Mission. Because in Dark Mission, we lay out a specific legal case by simply quoting the NASA charter.
Yes.
That under the chapter of, under the division of the U.S. Civil Code devoted to patent law, NASA is a DOD agency.
Yes.
It is a member of the Department of Defense. Under that specific provision of patent law, and people say to me constantly, well, why would you think that would make NASA, you know, military as opposed to civilian? And it all hinges, as you know, Joseph, on that key thing about patenting technology.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. No argument from me, Richard. I think if you want to put what you said in Dark Mission about patent law with respect to NASA and what I say in Gene's Giants with respect to patent law and genetic engineering and ancient texts, I think you're looking at basically one and the same scenario. In other words, you're looking at two components of a very, very huge picture.
Well, the other component is that John Kennedy knew.
Yes.
Now, I noticed that when George brought up the question, and I find I'm doing it myself, it's like at some point we have to get pregnant. As of tonight, we have an official CI memo from the Office of the President of the United States of America specifically directing the CIA to give UFO, he called them unknowns and knowns, information to the head of NASA, James Webb, who in turn was going to communicate this to the Soviets, to Premier Khrushchev and his people, all part of this campaign that Kennedy had worked on for years. Ever since he'd been elected, he wanted to get together with the Soviets, and instead of killing the human race in an all-out nuclear war, he wanted to involve the Soviet Union in this combined effort to go to the moon together and to share the prize. And the fact is tonight, that is a fact. That memo is an official memo. It came out under FOIA. It came out now under the Obama CIA, which I find very important.
Very interesting, yes.
And the dots are connecting. I mean, let me leap ahead. When you're talking about wars on elites and whether elites are on guard and they're trying to let some of us know, i.e. all of us know what's really going on, there is this most extraordinary and peculiar thing going on between the Obama administration and this damn royal wedding next week.
I know where you're going.
You know where I'm going, right?
Yes, I do.
The next shuttle mission, which is the last flight of the Endeavour shuttle, after which you will come home and be put in a museum in California.
Mm-hmm.
This last flight, STS-134, was originally supposed to take off last year, and they had all kinds of problems, George, and we've been on the show talking about some of these little technical problems.
Right.
They had to move it and move it and move it, and finally it was decided it was going to be April 19th. Yesterday, that mission was supposed to leave. Well, I'm in Amsterdam with Robin at the Secret Space Conference, and I get a note that Obama has moved the launch date of the last shuttle mission of Endeavour, STS-134, from the 19th to April 29th, which, of course, is the royal wedding date. Furthermore, he is launching it at 3:47 in the afternoon on, Eastern Daylight Time, which translates to 19.47 Greenwich Mean Time, excuse me, and he and Michelle and the girls are going to be in attendance at the launch. while the prince and princess are getting married in England.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Joseph, you take it from there, because to me, this is a tremendous window on this secret side of symbology, telling the British, particularly the City of London,
yes, the City of London.
Some major stuff that you talk about in Babylon Bankster. So take it away.
Well, yeah, I think you're right in terms of the publicity play here and the ritual that's involved. I think you're absolutely right, because, you know, as I detail in Babylon's Banksters, the whole scheme of the Banksters has been to substitute real money, which is state-issued and debt-free, with their facsimile of money, which is nothing but monetized debt, circulating debt. And, of course, the City of London is steeped, Richard, in that tradition of the Bank of England and the connections between the Bank of England and the old Dutch banking families in Amsterdam, and then from Amsterdam back to Venice and so on and so forth. So this is a direct... In my opinion, I think it's a direct snubbing of the nose on the part of President Obama to that whole crowd in London. And you know as well as I do that, at least in this country, the presence of the president and his family at the shuttle launching is going to upstage the royal wedding in terms of news coverage. So, you know, it's a direct snub, but it's a very subtle one too. If you wouldn't think about it unless someone like you came along and pointed it out. So, yeah.
but you know, at the same time, it's not like Charles and Diana. You know, it's
well,
it's
no, George. Let me beg to differ with you.
Why?
The Queen could die tomorrow.
Yeah.
And Prince William would then be the King of England. You're dealing with a potential head of state within the potential of this president's administration. You
what do you mean? What would happen to Prince Charles?
Well, Prince Charles is I'm not sure what the rules of succession are, but he would be the king. Well,
Charles would be the king.
He's the Queen's son.
But I think there's another aspect of this that Americans are under a tremendous misunderstanding. The crown still has extraordinary power in England.
Yes. Strange extraordinary power.
Yeah, very. Yes, you're right, George. It's very, very strange, the power and influence that they exercise, because it's very, very subtle. But we have to remember as Americans one very important thing, that no law passed by Parliament is a law until it is signed by the monarch. And there is nothing in the English Constitution, which is, of course, an unwritten constitution, there is nothing in the English Constitution that compels a monarch to sign a Bill of Parliament into law. So, in other words, the monarchy is still very, very important. It still has real power, and Americans are under the misimpression that you know, it's nothing but a figurehead monarchy. And the other problem that we have to take into account is that the House of Windsor has enormous wealth and deep, deep connections to this whole banking fraternity. So I think the symbolism here of President Obama's changing of the launch date and announcement that he's and his family are going to be there, rather than as a head of state attending a royal wedding in London, I think the analysis here is very right on. It's dead on, because this is a direct snub.
Well, remember the first thing that kind of raised some eyebrows when the president took over the Oval Office, the first thing he did the first day. Remember what that was, Joseph?
No, I don't.
He sent Winston Churchill's bust back to England.
Oh, that's right. I do remember that.
Which had been in the Oval Office since FDR.
FDR, that's right. That's
now,
right.
I'm thinking this is the second declaration of American independence. And the reason I'm thinking that is what occurred Friday night, the 8th of April, a couple weeks ago, when the president came out at 11:04 to deliver the message that the U.S. government was not shutting down, and that because they had managed to reach a deal across the aisle with the Republicans for $39 billion in cuts, 39 twice 19.5.
Five, right.
He made this address to basically tell everybody, calm down, the government's going on, everything's going to be open. And he did not do the address from the Oval Office. he did it from the blue room.
Yeah.
And in the open window behind him, you could see in the darkness, lit up in this ghostly fluorescence of the mercury vapor lamps, the Washington Monument, the spire, the Egyptian obelisk to, of course, George Washington. Flanking him over his shoulders were two presidents. And, George, this is going to be a little kind of quiz for you.
Let's see
how sharp you are as an historian. The guy on his left was Madison. The guy on his right was Thomas Jefferson. The guy in the middle, represented by the monument, was Washington. What do all of these three presidents of all our history, these three presidents uniquely have in common?
Common, yeah.
The Declaration of Independence.
But that's okay. It's something more relevant to tonight's discussion. Let's put it that way.
They were all Masons.
Okay, close, but no cigar.
Oh, come on, Richard. I'm getting real close. I'm warm.
Okay. They all declared war on England.
That was my third guess.
Now, what does that mean symbolically? See, what people don't get when I talk about symbolism is that, and Joseph, you know, if I'm wrong here, tell me, but there is a dual language. There is the public language.
Yes.
And then there's the deep, elite, symbolic language that goes back thousands of years.
Well, let me ask you about that, though, Richard. Who actually sits back and comes up with the symbolism for this to occur? Because, you know, as an outsider, I couldn't think of that. Somebody's got to be there that says, all right,
do you know about diplomatic codes?
No, I really don't.
Joseph?
Well, yeah, I think George, this illustration may help you. If you recall, when France surrendered to Hitler in 1940, mm-hmm. Hitler chose a very deliberate symbolism to conduct the surrender. He chose the very railroad car that Germany had surrendered to France in World War I to conduct the ceremony in, and he put it on the exact spot.
Okay.
You've got a similar kind of symbolism, I think, is what Richard is arguing here.
But I mean, he was turning the knife in, and he was twisting it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And what this was the other night was Obama's declaration of war, I believe, against the city of London, backed up by him upstaging this world-class event with what's going to turn out to be an even bigger world-class event because of his participation in the last shuttle flight. And don't forget, the commander of this mission, Mark Kelly, has a wife, a congressman from Arizona, Gabrielle Giffords, who came within a whisker, within microns, of being assassinated by an assassin's bullet to the head.
Yeah.
So true. Yeah, and by the way, they say that Prince Charles would become king if Queen Elizabeth ever abdicates her throne or dies.
Right.
But what they say is she may never die. And he will just merely give it to William.
Ah. Yeah, there is.
Which is possible. If she's a reptilian, like David Icke says, she'll stay on forever.
Well, I have heard talk of that, George. I've heard talk that the plan is that Charles would abdicate in favor of Prince William. But, you know, the royal family itself
There's a very important reason for that, and that is that William and Catherine represent the unification of two warring factions of the House of Windsor after about 300 years, called the Sophia Succession and the Jacobite Succession, that goes back to James I.
Richard, I want to thank you for joining us with Joseph Farrell. We're going to come back in a moment and take phone calls now with Joseph Farrell about genes, giants, monsters, and men.